From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, convicted of quadruple murder when he was 14. Today, Devante Sanford walks out of prison a free man as that conviction is tossed out.
This is a complete and utter failure of the criminal justice system. And the fact that we got it right now makes me feel very good, but it doesn't undo the damage that has been done to Devante Sanford.
The moth comes to Michigan.
I don't know whether it's a primitive urge or a reactive urge, but people want to come out and sit together, and they want to find out about each other.
50 paintings, 50 states. A West Michigan artist wraps up the ultimate road trip.
I was getting in my car to visit my son in Austin, and I thought, hey, I might as well throw my canvases in, and if I'm going to do that, I might as well make a project out of it.
Those stories and more. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today at the state capitol, a motorcyclist rights group is holding a rally. Later this hour, we'll get one of the organizers' perspectives on helmet laws and why he thinks they are a bad idea. But first, he was just 14 years old when he confessed to and was convicted of a quadruple murder in Detroit. But today, 23-year-old Devante Sanford walks out of Ionia State Prison a free man. His conviction was vacated Tuesday by Wayne County Circuit Judge Brian Sullivan. The judge agreed with arguments that Sanford's case had all the hallmarks of a false confession. David Moran is a University of Michigan clinical professor of law, and he directs the Michigan Innocence Clinic. He was co-counsel in this case. David, thank you for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
What were the inconsistencies in Devante's case?
First of all, you got to understand how Devante came into this. The police responded to the scene of a quadruple murder on Detroit's east side, and they found several neighbors milling around, and among them was Devante Sanford, a 14-year-old, 5'5" kid, wearing his pajamas. And for reasons that we can't fathom, the detective in charge of the case decided that this kid somehow knew something, took him downtown, interrogated him without a parent or guardian present for hours, brought him back home, and then the next day took him back down to Detroit Police Headquarters again without a parent and guardian present, and again interrogated him for hours. So the story that eventually emerges, the so-called false confession, was full of facts that were simply wrong. So Devante claimed that he and three other kids had committed this robbery and murdered all the occupants of the house. But the other three kids were all cleared within 72 hours. They all had rock-solid alibis. He said they each had a different kind of weapon. He named the four weapons they supposedly had. That didn't match the ballistics. In fact, there were only two perpetrators seen fleeing the house, and there were two types of bullets that were found at the scene that did not match up with the bullets that Devante claimed. He said where they dumped the weapons afterwards, the police searched there, and no weapons were found there. He said they met up at a Coney Island restaurant to plan the robbery beforehand, but that Coney Island restaurant had been closed for months. So virtually everything in the confession was false. In fact, what we did later was we had Jim Tranum, who is a nationally known police expert. He was a former detective in D.C. who was actually famous because he extracted a false confession in the 1990s from a woman. And then years later, she was exonerated and he went back and looked at it. And so since then, he's become an expert in what makes a confession false, how the police should do interrogations. Mm-hmm. And so co-counsel here was the Center on Wrongful Convictions of Youth at Northwestern Law School, led by Megan Crane. They contacted Jim Tranum in D.C., and he analyzed Devante's confession. And what he concluded was that every single fact that Devante got right in the confession was something the police already knew. Every single fact that the police didn't already know, he got wrong. And that's the hallmark of a false confession. The only things you're getting right are what the police already know. In other words, the police are feeding you the facts. He also analyzed Vincent Smothers' confession, which came sometime later.
In fact, let's go to this. Vincent Smothers, who is a professional hitman, admitted to the killings.
That's
and he
right.
did it 8 years ago. Why did it take so long for this day to come for Devante Sanford to go free?
And that's a great question for the Detroit police and the Wayne County Prosecutor's Office. So just 16 days after Devante Sanford was sentenced to 39 to 82 years, Vincent Smothers was picked up on a contract killing. And he tells the police that the gig is up and he will confess to all of the contract killings he committed over the previous few years. They turn the cameras on and Smothers confesses in great and extremely accurate detail to 12, including the four on Runyon Street. And what they ended up doing was charging him only with the other eight. And then they gave him a deal to second-degree murder, even though they had him cold for first-degree murder. They gave him, it gave him a deal to second-degree murder, which had the effect of preventing him from going to trial, because had he gone to trial, it almost certainly would have come out that he had confessed to Runyon Street as well.
And totally blown up what they had done.
That's right.
With Dante.
And his confession was extraordinarily accurate in every detail. Two perpetrators who fit the description of the perpetrators who were seen fleeing. He named his accomplice in the killing. He told the police where they would find one of the guns used in the killing, and they did, at a home associated with the accomplice. He said that the other gun would match some of the other, ballistically would match some of the other killings that he had committed, that he was confessing to, which it did. Everything fit together. And yet, the defense didn't find out about this for almost a year. The police and the prosecution kept it under wraps for nearly a year until the state appellate defender office, which was representing Devante at the time, finally found out about it.
As this has played itself out for all of these years, where is this resistance from the prosecutors coming from?
You know, I don't know.
Yeah.
Kim Worthy will be holding a press conference tomorrow, and I think that's a question for her. It's certainly not just a Detroit phenomenon. We find, and other Innocence Projects, Innocence Clinics around the country, in fact, even internationally, find that there is often great resistance to admitting that a mistake has been made. And even, frankly, wacky theories are advanced in order to try and explain away when the new evidence doesn't match the preconceived conviction. And so in this case, I know there was talk of that, well, maybe Vincent Smothers and his accomplice used Devante as an assistant, which was an idea that was just ridiculous to Vincent Smothers. I've met Vincent Smothers. We got a 26-page affidavit from him about the killings. And the idea that he and his adult accomplice would use a 5'5", 14-year-old kid to carry out a professional hit is just ridiculous. But it's the sort of cognitive dissonance that we see sometimes, is that the police and the prosecution just can't accept that they got it wrong. It's a human thing. And it's very difficult to accept that you got it wrong. And so they start spinning weird and wild theories as to how, well, maybe we still got it right after all. And I'm very thankful to Kim Worthy that faced with the Michigan State Police's reinvestigation, and that's what ultimately brought this case to a head, is we filed, the Center on Wrongful Convictions of Youth and the Michigan Innocence Clinic last April filed the motion for relief from judgment in Wayne Circuit Court. And as a result of that and the publicity surrounding that filing, the Michigan State Police got interested. Kim Worthy authorized a reinvestigation by the state police. That reinvestigation took over a year. But when it came out on May 20th, it was apparently, we haven't seen it yet, it was apparently devastating to the prosecution's case. And so Kim Worthy did the right thing and pulled the plug on it yesterday.
You do a lot of this kind of work around the country. David, put this case in context for us. How does Devante Sanford's case compare with other wrongful conviction cases you've worked on in the past?
Well, there are a lot of commonalities between this case and other cases around the country. There are now nearly 2,000 exonerations that are recorded on the National Registry of Exonerations at the University of Michigan Law School and Northwestern Law School. And many of the same causes of wrongful convictions that happen in the Devante Sanford case happen in hundreds of these other cases. So false confessions is a leading cause in about 25% of all the exonerations so far. The defendant falsely confessed. Police misconduct is a common feature of wrongful convictions. And in this case, apparently a police commander claimed that Devante, during one of the interrogation sessions, had drawn a very accurate map of the living room where the four people were killed. And in fact, eventually he admitted that Devante didn't draw that map and the police drew that map. So that's an example of police misconduct. The fact that they didn't turn over what Vincent Smothers was saying for nearly a year is an example of police misconduct. Terrible lawyering is a feature, especially in Michigan, but across the country, that leads to wrongful convictions. And Devante had a terrible lawyer in this case, a man who has been disciplined over and over again. His license is currently suspended for a B&E, but he's been disciplined or reprimanded, I believe, more than 20 times at this point.
And how is a 14-year-old kid going to know what kind of public defender has been appointed for him?
Right. Well, actually, his lawyer was retained.
He was retained. Okay.
He was retained by the family, but he never challenged the confession. I mean, the most obvious point to any competent attorney is that when a 14-year-old kid is taken in the middle of the night without his parents or his family or any guardian present and interrogated twice on two consecutive nights, 4 hours, emerging with a confession that is obviously false, does not match the facts, that is confession that should be suppressed. And there are constitutional grounds to suppress a confession like that. And he didn't even move to suppress it. The only other evidence against Devante at trial that had any significance was the surviving victim managed to crawl under a bed. So she couldn't see the perpetrators. But she heard the voice of one of the perpetrators. And she testified at trial that the voice of one of the perpetrators sounded like it could be Devante's voice. But Michigan law actually makes that sort of testimony inadmissible unless the victim or the witness has a prior familiarity with the voice. But again, the defense lawyer didn't move to suppress this unreliable, basically junk testimony that should never have come in the first place. So after hearing that testimony and hearing the confession of the officer, the confession of Dante through the testimony of the officer, the attorney told the family that it was hopeless and he should plead guilty. And so that's what Devante did. He pleaded guilty to 4 counts of second-degree murder midway through the trial instead of even finishing the trial because the case was hopeless, which, in fact, it was, given the extremely substandard representation of the lawyer.
It certainly is a story that is startling to the public, which would like to think that the wheels of justice move in the right direction and do the right thing.
They do occasionally. In this case, the wheels of justice finally moved in the right direction, but Devante Sanford lost 9 years of his life from age 14 to 23. And if we all think about how important those years are in our development, Devante Sanford spent much of that time in solitary confinement in Michigan State prisons because he was a kid. And this is a complete and utter failure of the criminal justice system. And the fact that we got it right now makes me feel very good, but it doesn't undo the damage that was been done to Devante Sanford.
David Moran, University of Michigan, clinical professor of law with the Michigan Innocence Clinic. Thank you so much for being with us, David.
My pleasure.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. To many of us, darkness and light are just something you affect by flicking on a light switch or lighting a candle. But for Katie Newell, light is a condition, a material that can vary in strength and form. She's a University of Michigan assistant professor of architecture, and the fascination she has with light could also conversely be described as fascination with darkness. That intertwinement is evident in her upcoming exhibition, Overnight. It opens June 11th and runs till November 6th at the Irving Stan Jr. Family Gallery at the University of Michigan Museum of Art. Katie Newell, welcome.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Can you describe the exhibition, particularly what's in it and the story that you're wanting to tell?
Overnight actually has two major components to it. The first part is a series of photographs, which are adding to something that I've been doing for years, a series called Nightly. And the second part of it is actually an installation. And both of those are grouped together. I have a great interest in nighttime and how that actually alters our spaces that we're used to seeing during the day and perhaps even, you know, architecturally speaking, gives us things that we don't normally see or even some impossibilities. Things seem to float, colors change, materials look a little different. So the Nightly photographs are recording the transition we've been going through in Detroit from having less than 40% of our streetlights to now where we have the implementation of the new infrastructure of the LED light system. And what has happened is we've gone from very dark setting, lights that if they were there were lit from sodium vapor lamps and copper wiring, and now we have LED, which is much brighter, much colder, and they're lit from aluminum, which even though it's less efficient, is less likely to be scrapped. So the work records that transition and records how I see the nighttime and how I'm kind of capturing spaces in their darkness. And then the installation feeds back on those material changes going from copper to aluminum and how it's lit both day and night.
What is that change like, having gone from copper to aluminum?
The copper to the aluminum change is more of the kind of impetus for how I make the material choices of the installation. I'd say visually what you're actually seeing the difference of is the sodium vapor to the LED lights. And it's different colorations, brightness. It's kind of a sort of change of what you see. I mean, basically what's happening is we're losing our darkness in Detroit. I'm not actually happy about it, to be honest. I know a lot of times things for safety, things for illumination or just kind of the general getting systems back online. We, of course, want the streetlights, and I can see that. But we did and are losing this amazing moment where there is this sort of beautiful calm, these wonderful things that happen when something actually falls in darkness, which we actually, in most of our lives, just as you said in the introduction, yeah. we we flip it away.
We flip it away.
We don't let ourselves see darkness that often, to be honest.
I wonder why that is. Maybe we don't. Is there some deep-seated fear
of
darkness?
There is. I've been doing research on darkness for a long time. I actually spent a year in Rome a handful of years ago studying darkness and night for that entire year. And with that, reading scholarly material, reading more anecdotal things, and, of course, you know, building up these sets of photographs, there is a deep-seated fear. There is something where we know things are different. We don't necessarily trust one another the same way in the darkness.
You think of the old goblins and ghoulies and long-legged beasties and things that go bump in the night, right?
The history of the streetlight comes from trying to wipe away the evils of night. It's just kind of adding to that as well, but maybe with a little bit of slant of trying to see some of the beauty in that moment of darkness too.
Do you think, as an architect, as somebody with that design eye, because there are some who say, yeah, the lights are coming back in Detroit, but they're ugly. I've heard that. Could there have been a better way? I guess, you know, we can't reinvent the wheel. I mean, lights are on. Safety and public safety is important. But could there have been a way to meet that but not make them so what people feel might be cold and ugly?
They are really bright. They're laid out in a very mathematical way, too, where they end up hitting on strange moments. And not necessarily always illuminating where someone may be and instead illuminate a vacant lot or something. I think it's, you know, it'd be an amazing undertaking to put the money into a change or to really think through it. But I think it could have been done in different ways. Things that are maybe even lower to the ground, things that become pedestrian level as opposed to lit high from above. I do find the LEDs quite harsh, quite bright. And something that I think actually also, it messes with our circadian rhythms. It kind of plays with the harshness of the landscape already. And so I am a big believer that there's different ways to be lighting the night.
Well, that's, or just lighting our worlds, because you're talking to someone who works in a space that has no exterior light whatsoever. Mm. And the office is basically LED. And one of my coworkers said, it's soul sucking. So you are actually opening us up to talk about that effect of light. We're sitting in a studio without the soul-sucking lights that we have in the office. And
right.
That's, but it's, well, it's practical, it's energy efficient, so there's that for it.
Right.
I don't know, is there an answer?
I don't know, there's a trade-off. Mm-hmm. I think there's a great trade-off. I actually think we miss something when we don't get the darkness in us. We miss a sort of calm. Part of the series I've done, not what's being shown in Michigan, I've also done a lot of photographs in the interior of people's homes in complete darkness. And I have to say, those are such impactful experiences because people start to open up in such a way. I've had the most intimate conversations with complete strangers when I sit in their house with them in total darkness, because I think there's a moment where there's a part of us that we're burning away, basically, with other lights. And I think there is a loss to that. And I think with all this sort of stimuli we have in our environment, it causes anxiety, it causes distraction, messes with our sleep.
What attracts you to Detroit to create so much of your art? Because I went to your website, to KathleenNewell.com. You are known not only for your photographs, but your installations, your urban interventions, and so much of it is in Detroit.
Right. Well, I'm from the area. And I very much so do installations about what is around me. I'm very keen to react to the circumstances that are happening at any given time. And so being in Detroit, the realm of installations have gone from everything of doing a piece on arson to theft to vandalism to historic eradication. Now, of course, I'm responding a little bit with the scrapping industry and also things happening with the LED lights. And so for me, part of it's my surroundings and a dedication to the city. I greatly enjoy living there, and my family is there and around. So I think the kind of passion of having watched it and watched it go through so many years and so many transitions, my installation work is not something that's looking to fix any problems. It really ends up being sort of a commentary on the circumstances that are happening at any one moment. And oftentimes they do end up being talking points for things that are going on in the city. Not as a way to say, okay, this is how we should do it, or look at what can now be done going forward. But it's a moment of pause where it stops and it highlights the same issues that everyone's talking about, but does it actually in a way that's meant to be very spatial, very beautiful, something that sort of asks people to stop for a second, to sort of slow down and look at actually what's in fact going on around us, and maybe see it, knowing that things are starting from existing conditions, knowing that we have what we have, that there are abilities to remake the materials and get things actually that we could never have done from starting from scratch, or opportunities that come out of things having become imperfect or having gone wrong aren't necessarily a bad place to start. It's my way of working with the city, communicating with the city. I do it not through words, but through the things that I make.
Overnight will open June 11th. It'll be at the Irvingston Junior Family Gallery at the University of Michigan Museum of Art, and it will run until November 6th. Katie Newell, it was great talking with you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's say you're a painter. You've spent years capturing the beauty of your home state, and now a new adventure calls to you. Hit the road with your paints, brushes, canvases, and easel, and capture a landscape from all 50 states. Do you talk yourself out of this immense undertaking, or do you give in to that siren call? Saugatuck artist Anne Corlett said yes to the call of adventure. And after 3 years, 29,604 miles of driving and 164 days away from home, she has done it. The result is easel on down the road, 50 paintings representing each of the 50 states. Anne Corlett is with us now from Saugatuck. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Cindy. Thank you for having me on your show.
Where'd you get this idea, all 50 states?
I hadn't been to all 50 states, so that was one thing. I wanted to see the country. My children were out of the house, and I was newly single, and I guess I could. I also, as an artist, kind of decided I needed to have the equivalent of the great American novel, if you will. You know, not that I could achieve that, but I think thinking big helps you get places. I was getting in my car to visit my son in Austin, and I thought, hey, I might as well throw my canvases in, and if I'm going to do that, I might as well make a project out of it. It sort of happened by accident.
I can only imagine the logistics of this entire project to say, all right, all 50 states, which means driving to 48 and flying to Alaska and Hawaii, and
right.
You can't just check out of life for all that time, right? You got to pay
right.
the bills.
Right, right. So I would do anywhere between 1 and 7 states at a time. So that's why it took 3 years. I would go on a short little jaunt, you know, and pick up Ohio and New York. Or most of 2015, I took 2 long trips out west because I didn't want to be away from home for longer than a month at a time.
As I looked on your website, I went to annecorlett.com and I found the easel on down the road link, and I looked at your paintings from this project. What went into choosing the scene from each state? I mean, how do you even begin to decide, okay, I'm in Texas and this is what I want to paint?
Right, right. So it was really random a lot of the time. What I realized partway into this project was it wasn't really about finding the quintessential landscape, because believe me, you're in a beautiful place, California or Alaska or New Mexico, you know, Maine, and how do you pick just one landscape? I mean, everywhere you look, there's something to paint. So instead, I just decided this is the day I'm painting and I have to find a site today and do it. I set up some rules for myself so it didn't become ungainly and just painted wherever I was, basically. A lot of times a local would tell me, give me suggestions, and that's kind of how I met people. I'd stop them on the street and say, okay, where should I paint?
You've got seascapes, you have downtown Chicago, but I noticed for New York, you didn't give in to the temptation to do the New York skyline. You had something very different.
Oh, New York was such a beautiful place. It also depended where I stayed. So about a third of the time I would stay with family or friends, and I was staying with my nephew in Ithaca, and that is at the bottom of the Finger Lakes, and the cliffs and the water in that area of the state are just incredible. So that was such a different landscape. Me either. I would never think of New York State and think of that landscape. And that was what was special, was finding all these secret places, really. You know, earlier you talked about logistics. One of the first things that happened is I put the canvases, I just have this little teeny Honda Fit, and I would put the hatchback up and fit all my painting supplies, the wet paintings, and my luggage in the back of this little car.
Wow.
And what I realized, I initially used a sweater drying rack and to stack the paintings so that air would go around them. Well, it never even occurred to me that the oil paint fumes would make me dizzy, and they did. So eventually I bought a trailer, little teeny trailer, that would house 8 paintings and the supplies. So that helped me get around without losing any more brain cells.
Now, was there ever a point in all of this when you were driving in clearly some area where you'd never been before? Did you ever feel afraid or ever ready to say, you know what, this is just too much? What was I thinking?
Yes, there were plenty of times when I was afraid. In fact, sometimes I have dreams still, you know, that I'm driving along a cliff and I can't see. Sometimes I'd be on a road and there'd be no markers and it'd be real narrow. Or I'd stay in some sticky little motel, you know, on a back two-lane highway and think, what was I thinking? But in the end, people are very open and nice and kind. And one of the things that came out of this for me is that humanity is really good overall. You know, we hear the news and we get so discouraged about the world at large, and yet people one-on-one are there for you. You know, you ask them for help, they give you help. And actually, even though I was frightened at certain different times, I was never actually in real danger that I knew of, and everything came out fine.
And we hear complaints that America's just, it's just become too much the same. As you go from state to state, they're the same businesses, same chains, same restaurants. But you can now say, you're the first person I think I've ever talked to, I can say you have been to each of the 50 states. Can you tell us, does each state have its own flavor, its own distinct characteristic?
Oh, absolutely. And I think driving to the states makes a difference than flying, because as you cross from one state into the next, you feel the gradual change. It's in landscape, but sometimes it's in dialect. It's in how people speak. It's in the kinds of foods. Boy, when I was in the Southwest, I felt like I was in a foreign land. Or the Badlands were like landing on the moon. You know, I mean, you can hardly believe our country is just so huge. It's fabulous how much open space there is, and the variety of landscapes, you know, just tickled me pink. I couldn't believe it.
And then as you would come home after a road trip, what did Michigan look like to you in that context of having been a road warrior and then back to West Michigan?
Yeah. Oh, boy. You know, it's one of the things that felt best about every trip was coming home. I always felt so lucky to live here. Michigan is so beautiful. You know, I live near Lake Michigan. The beaches are gorgeous, and I go out and paint on the dunes all the time. We live in a very hydrated state, and when you go west, it can be so dry. And, of course, we know the drought that's been in California and the other western states. And I would come home and think, boy, am I lucky. I mean, Michigan, the rest of the country is beautiful, but this is truly a special place to live.
And you have a book coming out about this undertaking, Easel On Down the Road, A Journey to Discover. What did you discover through this about being an artist?
Oh, you're so kind to ask this question, because it stretched me as a person and an artist. As an artist, you have a language of shapes and mark making and even color. And when you go to a landscape you've never been, you are really pushing yourself into the unknown. So it was unknown of travel, but it was also an unknown of my work. And it took a certain amount of courage. And so I learned that I could succeed in the travels and the paintings, which helped me understand that I can succeed in anything, really, that comes my way in life. So that was one of the big things that I brought home, is that if you push yourself a little, and you'll be amazed what you can do. And, you know, painting is really an analogy for life in general, at least for me.
How so?
It takes courage to be a painter. There's no structure. You have to create your own structure. There's no right answer. So that's kind of like life. And what I realized is if I let go of an expectation for how a painting is supposed to look, I'm more open to any result, and anything can happen. And that is true for life, too. I found if I let go of my expectations, not of just what's going to happen tomorrow, but what's going to happen in the next 10 years, then I'm more open to anything that might happen.
You can find out more about Ann Corlett's work, her book, and the project Easel On Down the Road by going to her website, anncorlett.com. And we should note it is Ann, A-N-N-E, so put that E in there at the end. You're going to be exhibiting these paintings around Michigan?
Yes, I'm so glad you asked. The Sarduk Center for the Arts is really a wonderful venue. They host theater and music and all kinds of interesting programming, and I will be in their gallery from June 10th until August 16th. That's in Saugatuck, of course, and the opening is June 10th and open to the public, and we are hanging the paintings starting tomorrow, and I'm hanging them chronologically, so if you go to the exhibit, you'll kind of be taking the trip with me.
Very fun, and I'm sure the book will be fun to read, too. Ann Corlett, it was great talking with you, and thank you for sharing your journey with us on Stateside.
Thank you so much. My pleasure.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Some fine storytelling is coming to the Wharton Center at Michigan State University. The Moth Main Stage is happening tomorrow night, June 9th, in East Lansing. With us is the producer of the Moth Radio Hour, heard right here on Michigan Radio, Jay Allison. Welcome.
Happy to be here.
For those who might not be familiar with the Moth Main Stage, exactly what's going to happen?
Well, you're going to just hear great stories about people's lives. I mean, people will stand up. There'll probably be five of them, and there'll be a host. And one after another, you're going to hear stories that will range across all kinds of life experience. And they'll be funny, and they'll be sad, and you'll laugh and cry. And it's utterly simple and really moving. It's ancient and modern.
That's exactly what I wanted to get into. When I think of what's happening, it is taking us back through time to this ancient art of storytelling, of sitting with others, sharing stories, not sitting alone, staring at a screen, or not watching carefully edited reality TV. Do you feel like in your work with the Moth, you're carrying the torch for something that's in danger of being lost?
Well, I might have said it was in danger of being lost, but the success of the Moth convinces me otherwise. I don't know whether it's a primitive urge or a reactive urge, but people want to come out and sit together, and they want to find out about each other. And it's so fundamental. And you know what audiences do with the Moth is they give their full attention. They listen fully. And it's so rare to have that quality of attention with nothing to look at and not being bombarded with any kind of special effects or anything, but just to be occupied with listening to the narrative of another person's life. So I find it an incredibly hopeful phenomenon.
What you describe, it does seem rarer when I think of even the way that I might watch television. I usually have my iPad on my lap, and
I might be
checking on the IMDb to see who that actor on Game of Thrones was in another movie or something. And so we're always having our attention drawn away. So that beauty of let's all focus and you could hear a pin drop must be, it's magical.
I think there's a kind of gluttony about that sort of wanting to keep increasing the input. I mean, I feel it too. I'm not saying like I'm above it. I do the same thing. I'll have several things going, and you think maybe you're getting more, but you aren't really. You're skipping along the surface. And the Moth lets you kind of go deeply into something, and that's when you get moved. You know, like how often you get moved when you're watching TV and got a cell phone and have an iPad. You know, I mean, you're making yourself inaccessible, I think.
Jay, as producer of the Moth Radio Hour, you have heard God knows how many stories. And I'm just wondering for yourself, what are the kind of stories that really, really touch you, the kind you can't forget?
You know, there isn't one kind, but there is a quality of risk when the storyteller, you know that they're out on a wire, that they feel compelled to tell the story, and it scares them a little bit to be doing it. And sometimes it's a revelation that they're giving as a gift to the audience. And when you can feel that happen, you can't take your ears off it.
Yes. Another question I've got, and now that you might be the one to be able to ask something that I've always wondered, what do you know about the story behind the choice of that name, the Moth?
Well, the founder of the Moth, a guy named George Dawes Green, great guy, novelist, he lived in Sea Island, Georgia, and he and his friends would gather on their friend Wanda's front porch and tell stories late into the night with bourbon, and the moths would fly through the holes in the screen and bang against the naked light bulb there, and hence the name.
That is great. You're the first to tell me exactly how that came to be, and it just fits so much. Because this does, even though people are going to be at the Wharton Center at Michigan State University tomorrow night, it still has that sense of sitting around the campfire as happened in prehistoric days.
Yeah. And, you know, I think it'll be, I hope it'll be a great show. There are great storytellers in Michigan. We did a Michigan special radio hour that was absolutely terrific. So I'm sure it'll be wonderful.
Now, are the storytellers on tap tomorrow night all Michigan based, or are they coming from all over?
Well, usually it's a mix. There'll be some local people, I'm sure, and then maybe there'll be some that are kind of traveling around telling their story. That would be my guess. Some may have come up through the slams. You know, we do slams in Michigan and 20-some other cities, too. Some people come in that way. Some people call our pitch line at themoth.org, and we develop their stories like that. And the directors work with them. So the stories you'll be hearing tomorrow night are going to be worked on a little bit. Not too much, though. Like, just kind of coming out of the oven. That's the ideal.
Like a good pie crust. You don't want to mess with it too much and ruin it.
Yeah, you don't want to overbake it.
The Moth Main Stage happens at 7:30 tomorrow evening at the Wharton Center at Michigan State University. You can get tickets and more information by going to whartoncenter.com. Jay Ellison, producer of the Moth Radio Hours, heard Saturdays at noon and 8 p.m. right here on Michigan Radio. Thank you for being with us, and thank you for filling in that question I always had about the origin of the name. It was great talking with you.
Oh, no, not at all. Have a great time.
Hundreds of motorcyclists are rallying today in Lansing, sending a message to state lawmakers: keep hands off the no helmet situation. It has been 4 years since the repeal of the state law requiring motorcycle riders in Michigan to wear helmets. That effort was led by Abate of Michigan, the nonprofit cycling rights group that's leading today's rally. We've got Vince Consiglia with Abate with us now from Lansing. Vince, is riding a cycle with a helmet just not as fun?
It's not as fun to most than some people. It's the rider's choice. I mean, we stress responsibility. You know, let that rider decide on their own.
What is your view of the law that requires us to wear seatbelts?
Same thing. I think it's a rights issue. Fortunately for me, I don't drive a car very much or a truck, so I don't have to deal with it. But I average about 25,000 miles per year on a motorcycle and have since 1974, so...
I guess I'm wondering, do you think the government, what we're seeing with seatbelt laws and smoking restrictions, is kind of the government trying to help people help themselves and to move them away from dangers that are unsafe, such as driving without a seatbelt? If people won't do it, then you say you have to do it, and you see the death rate goes down. And I guess I'm trying to see how that's any different from taking the risk of riding a motorcycle and risking one's head coming in direct contact with pavement.
Well, the difference would be... there's no guarantee when you ride a motorcycle. If you are riding at 60 miles an hour and you hit head-on, there's no helmet that can protect you. People have that perception, oh, I don't know how to ride, but if I wear this helmet, I'm going to be safe. And it's not true. If you don't have the skills, that car pulls out in front of you, you can't brake, you can't swerve, you're going to hit the car. That's all there is to it, because the car will stop right in your path. And if you don't have the skill to swerve or the skills to stop, then you're not going to be able to survive that.
What about the long-term health costs, the higher medical costs, Medicaid, long-term care for people who are injured?
Same thing. Most, if you have a $20,000 or $30,000 motorcycle, chances are you're going to have insurance and you're going to have medical coverage. Yeah, there are some people that slip through the cracks, but let's face it, motorcycle is not a cheap sport. I'm sorry that some people probably aren't aware of it, but... yeah, a pair of leather gloves costs more than what the training class costs.
Ultimately, though, aren't all of us winding up, when these people get hurt, with the long-term Medicaid payments, long-term care costs?
Well, I think that could be true, like you said, of the overweight person, the heavy smoker, the, you know, all those categories you mentioned before. But like I said, most of the motorcyclists that I know, people that I know that ride, that's their lifestyle. For insurance, we pay, cyclists pay into the catastrophic fund for every single vehicle. So I pay, you know, five times in the catastrophic fund. How many times can I be catastrophic? Once. But yet I pay five times in the state of Michigan for every vehicle that I have for catastrophic insurance.
What, Vince, do you think needs to happen to get riders and drivers to follow better safety practices in this state?
the whole distracted driving thing. I think that we have to focus some issues on definitely on teens and education, but all facets of the traffic mix, you know, have people look, have people be more aware of the different, you know, not only motorcyclists, bicyclists, all the traffic users. Certainly we, you know, favor more motorcycle education, but we need more of a media presence. We need more enforcement as far as, you know, if you are constantly getting these tickets, there should be some sanctions as far as your license. And then certainly for this unendorsement thing, we're 40% of the fatalities each and every year in Michigan since 1989 did not have a cycle license. We're not properly licensed. I give the state police credit, and we, Abate, supported it, what they call the Shadow Rider Program. They made mailed a postcard to these people and said, hey, we know you own a motorcycle, but you don't have a cycle license. That reduced it from 20% to 15% that didn't have it. But yet last year, 2015, they were 57% of the fatalities.
You're saying we got to get people without the endorsements off the roads and off those motorcycles.
Yeah. If they talked about it and then they backed off, they put up billboards in the Detroit area with a guy towing the motorcycle, all of a sudden that spiked registration in the classes. They did it for 30 days, and they took the billboards down. Hmm.
Vince Consiglio is with Abate of Michigan. It's the nonprofit cycling rights group spearheading today's motorcycle rally at the state capitol. Vince, thanks for taking time to talk with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Human trafficking is a growing problem in our state, with reported cases up 16% in 2015 from the year before. And that's only reported. Many go unreported. The Detroit International Human Trafficking Summit is happening tomorrow in Detroit. One of the goals is to train companies to better identify when trafficking might be happening. Here to talk about the 101 of human trafficking for businesses is Gary Lilicki, Executive VP of Quality Training and Product Design for Health Management Systems of America, HMSA, a Detroit-based employment assistance provider. Gary, who'll be at this summit and what's the goal?
Corporate leaders, religious leaders, community leaders, in the Detroit, in and around the Detroit area, so Wayne, Oakland, Macomb County, southeastern Michigan, to really educate them and give them a better awareness about human trafficking, because it's such a clandestine industry. It's kind of underground. Not a lot of statistics out there, not a lot of people talking about it. It sort of reminds us of domestic violence and alcoholism 40 years ago. People kind of knew what's going on, but shh, we don't talk about it. It's not polite. It's not the right thing to do. We don't get involved.
Yeah.
That type of thing.
Yeah.
We need to get people involved. We need to get people aware of what's going on, signs and symptoms, and what to do if, in fact, you see who to contact, so that we have thousands of more eyes on the street in our neighborhoods. So the training, if you think about it, yeah, healthcare providers, teachers, hotel, motel, people that you would say, yeah, absolutely, they need to be trained. But if you start thinking about it and going all the way down the line, down to city utility workers, cable repair people, UPS drivers, postal workers, they all go in and out of homes and in and out of businesses every single day. And maybe they see something that just doesn't look right, but I'm not sure what it is, and I don't even know who to contact, so they forget about it. But if they're trained,
yeah,
they can spot something that maybe you and I can't, because we're not going in and out of businesses all day long or out of homes all day long, but they can. So you don't have to be a police officer or a doctor or a teacher. It can be all the way down the line. The more people trained, that's our premise,
yes,
the better.
What kinds of things are you training people to spot? And this idea that maybe something isn't right, something as is?
Well, for example, there's a lot of signs and symptoms that are there. So if it's labor trafficking, if you have a lot of people living in one spot in closed quarters, if they don't speak our native language, somebody speaking for them, they don't have their papers with them. Maybe they don't know exactly where they're at, where they're located at, you know, but I'm here doing this work, you know, for this type of person. If it's more sexual trafficking, definitely they would be, many people are underage. So if they're underage and in prostitution, absolutely. They could be tattooed or branded with the trafficker's name or symbol of some kind. That's really becoming a common theme We're hearing from the FBI and the prosecutor's office. If you see kids hanging around with older people all the time, if they have more money than they should, if they are dressing a little different than age appropriate, there's a variety of different symptoms that are there. Now, again, this is not an inclusive list, and it doesn't mean somebody's being trafficked if it's like that.
But
these are you start
your spider sense goes off.
You ask other questions.
You ask other questions.
Right.
And then what?
And then locally, you know, you've got the FBI, the Southeastern Task Force of the FBI. They really focus on underage sexual trafficking. Any prosecutor's office has got investigators, you know, to be able to do that. Attorney General's office, any police force has a sexual task force, you know, that would be involved in that. It's a matter of just making sure you yourself are not attempting to intervene or rescue or, you know, something of that nature. Because a trafficker is not going to be any less dangerous than a drug seller. It's a very profitable industry. It is the largest criminal, growing criminal industry in the world, over $150 billion a year worldwide. So they don't want you stopping their flow of money. So you would contact the authorities and say, this is what I'm seeing. This is what's going on.
And take it from there.
And let them take it from there. Yeah.
I saw as I was at the top of our conversation, I was talking about the reported cases in our state going up, and I saw you nodding. Mm-hmm. So this is really something we need to confront.
Absolutely. The National Trafficking Hotline, which is run by the Polaris Project out of Maryland, they will be at our conference on June 9th. Giving us national statistics as to what's going on everywhere, including Michigan. But Michigan was up 16% last year in reported, as you had said, which does not mean it's not more than that because most of it goes unreported. But 16% increase, that's huge. And they pointed that out to us saying, you know, we're noticing this uptick here. There's something that's going on, you know, in your state. And the FBI knows it. County Prosecutor's Office knows it. Attorney General's Office knows it. But the public needs to know about it, needs to be aware that this is an issue in our state, and we can do something about it.
I mean, you people train. That's what that's what you're good at. So is that your part in this fight?
That is HMSA's part, yeah. We are train our client companies all the time within the EAP benefit. So whether that's beating the holiday blues or sexual harassment or drug-free workplace, you know, something of that nature. So we said we can train on this. We can train on a human trafficking and slavery 101 for all these corporations or parishes or religious leaders or community leaders. We have the ability to do that. That's our niche. We're not going to go on raids with the FBI, and unfortunately we can't house victims. We don't have that ability. But we can train. That is part of our expertise. So that's how we got involved and how we're going to be involved going forward.
And is there still possibility if someone wants to attend?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Our website, because we have partnered with Liberty and Freedom Now, it's 501(c)(3) corporation, would be lfnow.org. And you can go right to the website and register at that point. Or, you know, if you want to register the day of and pay, you certainly can do that too. But in the main ballroom at Cobo Hall on June 9th, and we start promptly at 8, and it's going to go to about 4 in the afternoon.
Busy, busy day. Gary, thank you so much for sharing this with us. Gary Lilicki, who is the Executive VP of Quality Training and Product Design for Health Management Systems of America, as we look at the Detroit International Human Trafficking Summit happening tomorrow at Cobo in Detroit. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that's today's Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and thank you for listening.